should be taken with a grain of salt, something unfortunately Jonathan Vankin did not do. What you're going to hear next is an account of what happened with the center from a woman named Pat, and again, with the exception of Karen Gunn, I'm only using people's first names. This particular tape segment is about 41 minutes in length, and it begins as follows.
Alrighty, now what we're going to be doing during the following portion of the program is to do what Jonathan Vankin did not do, namely investigate what actually happened. We're going to be speaking with some of the volunteers for the Mae Brussels Research Center. In fact, we will get most of them on tape this evening. Some of them I don't know. I don't know who they are or how to contact them. Some have moved on. But the majority of them will be interviewed in order to get their opinions on what happened and their personal recollections of the problems with the center, conflicts with John Judge, etc. I want to state at the outset, of course, that these are the opinions of the various volunteers, and I want to reiterate that I myself have no firsthand information about this, since I never set foot inside the Mae Brussels Research Center and was not involved as a volunteer. We have on the phone with us now Pat, whom I actually have never met, but she was one of the main volunteers and is in a position to give us her view of exactly what happened with the center, what the problems were, her recollections of John Judge, what happened with the various other volunteers, and so forth. So, Pat, why don't you tell us what, in your opinion, happened with the center and recollect the events that unfolded and the problems with John Judge and the other volunteers as best you can.
Okay, well, I met John through another political group in town, and he seemed to be an intelligent, interesting person, and he asked me if I would consider doing volunteer work for the center, and I said yes. I then met with other volunteers, and I recommended several people who John ended up asking to be volunteers and other employees there. And John had some very strange habits that were kind of annoying, but on a basis of maybe 3 or 4 hours a week that I was working there, really did not disturb me that much until I heard them constantly from other people. And when the volunteers and the employees finally got together, what we found out is that the same thing was happening to every one of us. And those specific things were that John constantly lied. I would call him a pathological liar, except that I don't have a degree, and I probably shouldn't be using that term.
Can you give us your recollections of some of the specific incidents involved?
Yes. The specific incidents involved were around the work that was being done at the center. John was taking the credit for all of the work that was being done by the volunteers and the employees. John, I really never saw John do any work at all. John would not get up until 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and then he would spend almost the whole evening on the telephone with friends. And he would present me with something that I had to do the next day and tell me that it was prepared by him, and I would find out later that it was prepared by the office manager or other volunteers. He would ask me to do things and then tell other people that he and I had done them together when there were 42 telephone calls to be made, and I made 40, and he did 2 that I refused to make. And that was very frustrating. Also, you just couldn't count on anything he said. He just lied constantly, and if you confronted him with what was going on, he would just lie about that.
Now, I want to reiterate that this is the opinion of this volunteer. This is in no way to cast aspersions on what she's saying, but I want to reiterate that I myself was not involved with the center except to donate money to the center to promote very heavily the Dan Sheehan fundraiser, which kicked off the formal solicitation efforts. And I also offered John in October of '88 the position of being my co-host after Nip Tuck left, an offer that John declined. So once again, this is the opinion of this volunteer. Can you give us some specific examples, Pat?
Well, as I said, just taking credit for other people's work That was the main thing.
Did he ever take credit for something that you had done?
Yes. There was a telephone list of calls that had to be made, and for some reason they had to be made at 9:30 in the evening because information had been given out to people that was erroneous at the time. And he called me at 10 o'clock at night and told me that these calls had to be made. And he sort of let me know that he was not going to be able to make them. So I took almost the entire list, and I told him there were two people that I would not call because I knew it would involve long, involved conversations. And so he called two people, and I called 40. And the next day he told the office manager that he and I had split the list down the middle. And 40 to 2 is not a split, as far as I'm concerned. Some of the other things, friends of mine who became volunteers, John called them up at 11 o'clock at night and had them come over to the center to clean his bathroom. That was the incident that pretty much set me off. That was definitely abuse. And he then told me the next day that he had done it. And there was no way I could justify John's disrespect and use of people who were really trying to help and really trying to carry out May's wishes. And I knew at that point that John, or I felt at that point, that John had no respect for other human beings. And of course he had no respect for himself, that was obvious, so that's where it came from. But that I really didn't want to be a part of working with a person who would use other people and just not be respectful.
In other words, he had someone come over to clean his bathroom. Do you recall the first name of the individual involved?
Well, yeah, Betty and Terry.
Okay.
Are the ones that he called and had them clean his bathroom. And then he told me the next day that he had done it, and I didn't catch up with Betty and Terry. We were all working on different shifts, Dave, and that was kind of strange also because people who I spoke to on a regular basis I was no longer seeing because they were working at night and I was working during the day. And I didn't actually speak to Betty and Terry, who were friends of mine originally, for 3 or 4 weeks after that incident. And that's when I learned that they were the ones that had cleaned the bathroom. And that just happened with everything. There was the Monterey Pops Festival that three of us went down to table. He was supposed to have literature available for us, and it was supposed to be there by 7 o'clock in the morning, which is when we left. And he called Betty and Terry again at, I'd say, 11:30 at night and had them go out and make all of the copies. And they told me that he had called them several times, and when they came around to the center, he wasn't even there. Of course, he took credit for having them ready for us, and we didn't find out until later that someone else had done it. I'm trying to remember what else. He had feelings about the two employees who worked at the center. And he was constantly talking to other people about negative things about other people, but never would deal directly with the person who he had the complaint about.
What were the first names of these two people?
Gaia and Aya.
Okay. And we will be interviewing Aya later in the broadcast.
Right, and if he had any problems or if he was experiencing any hostility with Aya, he would come and tell me about it. But he wouldn't tell Aya about it. And I kind of figured that he was doing the same with me, and I know he did the same with Gaia, and he constantly did that. He sort of, I think he tried to pit us against each other. I think that he really hoped that we would not get close, because what happened when we did get close is we all started talking and found out that we had one common enemy, and that was John. And that he was really, I don't know whether he had a master plan, but it sure did seem like he did. And in that kind of situation, working at the center was not like working for the 4-H Club. We had to feel relatively certain and safe about where we were, and we were not feeling that at all. There was an awful lot of tension. There were lies all the time. The fact that John was doing no work at all. And then he met a woman over the phone. And I think that was that was a very big problem.
Was this the woman Wendy?
Yes. Yes. And John met her long distance over the telephone, did not know anything about her, except what she told him. We didn't really know anything about her. They fell in love over the telephone.
Now, just one second, Pat.
This is according to John, sorry.
Okay, now, I have heard of the woman, Wendy. Kyan has already discussed some of the problems. The audience will have heard that by the time this goes on the air.
Okay.
I myself never met Wendy. I have only heard third person about her. But I was not aware that they had not met before. It is your recollection that they met over the telephone?
Had not met before. Aya can tell you more about that, but yes. No, they had never met before.
So this was almost like a 1-800-TALK kind of thing.
Yes, but, well, she worked with Knight Ridder Press and was having something to do with the newsletter, and that's how they met. John was trying to get the first newsletter published.
Mm-hmm.
And I think she ended up doing a favor for him. And it was within 2 or 3 days that John was walking around talking about being in love, and they were in love. And he told us at one time that Wendy had gone to a cocktail party with William Bennett, which really made us shudder. And we were kind of concerned about his relationship with her because it just seemed that he was a very easy target. He was very, very lonely, and I would describe his behavior when I first met him as that being very depressed and very lonely. And it just seemed like a perfect setup. Here he meets someone over the phone. And I think it was about 2 months later, or maybe a shorter period of time, that they decided to get together. And the rendezvous place was the research center. And that's what really did it, because John had maintained a fairly strict rule about not bringing anyone to the center, about no one knowing where the center is, not even giving out the telephone number. We were subject to his, not his paranoia, but his caution on the subject that sometimes we felt was a little overboard, but we all went along with it, and we all did feel that we had to keep this between ourselves and no one else should know about it. We had to be very careful. And then John invites this woman that he's never even met before to the center.
Okay.
And that caused a whole big clash. We told John that we didn't think that he was really in any shape to judge at this point because he was involved in a personal relationship with her, and we didn't think it was very smart. We didn't want her at the center. We didn't want to be around. We didn't want our names to be around her. We suggested that he meet her at a motel or a hotel or take her away for the weekend, anything but the center. And he totally disregarded anything we said, and he had his weekend at the center and everyone else left.
So he had not actually met Wendy?
No, this was their first meeting.
Again, I've not heard this before. This is a first for me, so the listeners are learning right along with yours truly.
Yes, that was their first meeting. And it continued from there, and then there was an arrangement for... We found out about an invitation that John had printed up to several people, inviting them to the grassy knoll.
This was the picnic on the grassy knoll.
Right.
What this was supposed to be.
By John and Wendy of the Mae Brussels Research Center. And we actually had a copy of the invitation because he had sent it to Tom Davis.
I have, by the way, I was sent a copy of that same invitation.
I remember your name being on it because he mentioned several other people who might be there.
Now, let me just fill the audience in briefly about what this was supposed to be. This was supposed to be a gathering of researchers on the grassy knoll in Dealey Plaza in Dallas, Texas, in 1989, November 22nd, 1989, the 26th anniversary of President Kennedy's assassination. My name was on that particular document. One of my own recollections about this is that there was a meeting of the Mae Brussels Research Center, which, once again, I did not attend, but I heard from a number of the people involved that John told them that I had been sent already an invitation to this particular gathering. And some days later, I did receive an invitation to the picnic on a grassy knoll, But the letter, or the envelope, I should say, was postmarked 3 days after the meeting at which John assured people that I had been sent the invitation, and it was postmarked Washington, D.C. On top of that, Picnic, I was the only person that I am aware of that picked up on the acronym. Picnic was an acronym, P period, I period, C period, N period, I period, C period, standing for Public Information Creates New Intelligence Circles. One of the things that I found ominous about that, and I will discuss this later in the broadcast, is that the intelligence community has a habit often of taking things and actually putting them far enough out into the open so that a skilled observer can see what is going on, but that most people will not understand it. It's actually a way they have of mocking their enemies and those they feel are lesser than they are. One of my suspicions concerning the Mae Russell Center, and it began while John was back east getting his things together, was that the Mae Russell Center may very well have been a type of intelligence operation called a vacuum cleaner operation. What that is an operation set up to vacuum in information. Frequently, people will be given some information and told to write in to thus and such an address or to such and such an individual for more information. Their names then go into the files. We will never know whether or not for sure the Mae Russell Center was a vacuum cleaner operation, but for reasons that I will discuss later in the broadcast, that was and remains a suspicion of my own. When I saw the Picnic, quote-unquote, i.e. Public Information Creates New Intelligence Circles, that continued to fuel the suspicion which already existed. To the best of my knowledge, Pat, at least I have never heard from any of the other volunteers that, that they were aware, really, of that acronym, despite the fact that it was actually on the piece of paper.
I've never heard that before,
Dave. If you still have that piece of paper...
I don't, but I think that Aya does.
Okay, well, I'm going to try and get Aya to read that, because I will never forget that. When I saw that, well, it was one of the factors which led me to speak out against the center on the air. Go ahead, Pat.
If I remember correctly, and I can't be sure, I think that your name was on the piece of paper.
It was indeed, along with that of a great many other researchers.
And right.
I myself was less than thrilled because at this point I had effected a break with John Judge for reasons I will discuss later.
Right, and the strange thing was that it was John Judge and Wendy of the Mae Brussels Research Center, and no one from the Research Center had ever seen this before, and it was not reproduced or sent out from the Research Center. And that was something that, again, we need to confront John with, and we did at a meeting.
Mm-hmm.
Where did this come from? How come we didn't know about it? We were all part of the center at the time. And when has Wendy become a part of the center where she's using her name in relation to the center? And he just said that this really wasn't any of our concern. This was something he was doing on his own. It had nothing to do with the center, but there, right on the piece of paper, was, John and Wendy of the Mae Brussels Research Center.
Mm-hmm. And to recall that my envelope had been postmarked in Washington, D.C., which was not where the center was.
Yes, and I do believe, and this happened directly after John came back from Washington.
Mm-hmm.
And the only reason that we even had a copy of it was because it was sent to Tom Davis. Otherwise, we at the center never would have known this invitation was going out in the name of the center. And that was, as I said, it was something that we needed to talk to John about, and we felt we were being manipulated again.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that I would like to say something about Wendy, that I met Wendy once briefly, and I don't really know Wendy, and I never did, and I don't have anything per se against Wendy. What I objected to is that John was no longer using sound judgment in inviting someone into the center and perhaps exposing us all to something that we would not be exposed to if he had used the same judgment that he forced us to use. I don't think anyone really had anything against her personally because we never got to know her.
Cayenne did have a great many suspicions about Wendy in the interview that I conducted with her. She was suspicious of the fact that Wendy espoused a great respect for and love of Mae Brussels, And yet she quite apparently, according to Cayenne, didn't seem to know very much at all about Mae Brussel. Certainly was not part of her circle, and she claimed to have heard, according to Cayenne's account, I don't believe Cayenne said this on the tape, but I know when I spoke with her at the time, she said that Wendy had heard about Mae Brussel on a radio station in Los Angeles, but Cayenne had expressed suspicions of Wendy because of her lack of knowledge of Mae and the fact that this virtual stranger with very little background in terms of being a listener of and a student of Mae Brussel's work would all of a sudden want to come in and be a director of the Mae Brussel Center.
Yes, that was, we were suspicious of that as well, but as I said, we really didn't know Wendy, and it wasn't a personal objection to her personality.
Right, I also want to reiterate that I never met Wendy, wouldn't know her if I passed her on the street.
Right. Okay, so that became a major point, and all these things were brought up at a meeting, and John had no reaction. None whatsoever. And there were about 12 people in the room.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't a matter of, well, John, you told someone that you did this when I really did it. It was 10 people repeating this over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
Because there was no doubt. We were amazed when we first got together and found out that he was doing the same thing to all of us. I don't know why we were amazed, but we were.
Mm-hmm.
We had no idea that this was going on. And John had no reaction. In fact, I'm not even sure John was there. I mean, I know he was sitting in the chair, but he didn't seem to be there at all. And actually, ever since John came back from Washington, he appeared to be a different person.
One of the things I noticed about John was that when I met him for the last time, and I only met John a total of 8 times, most of those times in connection with radio appearances, all of them professional meetings, with the exception of one. One was a gathering at Mae's in February of 88. But I noticed a very different expression in his eyes than the one I had remembered. This in and of itself is neither here nor there, but the expression in John's eyes, and there's an old saying that the eyes are the window to the soul or the eyes are the window to the mind, was completely different. And this was in October of 1989 at the first annual memorial service commemorating May's passing.
Yes, and it was also very strange what he said at that service.
I don't recollect his words.
Well, I don't remember his exact words, but everyone was doing a tribute to May, the person, and John came out with a report on the research center,
mm-hmm.
and nothing personal at all, not even one word about May herself.
One of these suspicions that Cayenne expressed, and I've heard this from a number of the volunteers that I have spoken to, was that John may have been under mind control.
We thought the same thing, either that or drugs. I had heard somewhere, and I can't remember the source, but so this is just hearsay, but John was taking some kind of medication for, I believe, blood pressure, and he had phlebitis.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't trust anyone to transfer his prescription to California. So he's still getting his medication from Washington. And at a certain point, Wendy was picking up his medication and sending it to him.
Hmm.
And so when we were faced with this new John, and I really saw it as a vacant look behind his eyes. I didn't see very much there. And it was a very strange feeling. I don't think I ever really connected with John in the first place, but I really felt that he was absent,
mm-hmm.
after a certain period of time, and we did discuss both mind control or drugs, and if she was sending the prescriptions to him, that would have given her a very good opportunity, although I have no evidence whatsoever.
Well, again, I want to emphasize that people, the volunteers, are giving their recollections, and that is hearsay evidence, and as such, should be taken with a generous dose of salt. Which is not to cast aspersions on what you're saying, but
right.
for purposes...
No, I do not know this to be true.
Mm-hmm.
This was just something that we considered a possibility, and you would have to have been there and see John before and after.
This is in the category, then, of interesting if true.
Okay.
Okay,
also, it is my belief that John was anti-Semitic.
Why did you have that impression?
Okay, well, I am Jewish. And there were many times that John would inappropriately put things in about people being Jewish, Jewish culture, Jewish food, or the fact that someone that he was talking about at that time was Jewish.
Can you give us any specific
conversation with me that I don't feel he would have interjected with anyone else?
Can you give any specific examples?
He pointed out we were in San Francisco, and he pointed out a place that sold knishes, and he kept elbowing me and going, "Look, we sell knishes, knishes," as though because I'm Jewish, I would love a knish. And I asked him if he wanted one, and no, he didn't. So I wasn't quite sure of why he was doing that. That was an alert that he was talking to me, and he probably would not have said that to you. He probably would not have said that to very many people. And then he would introduce people into conversation when he's telling me a story about, "Oh, I've got to tell you this about my friend so-and-so, who, by the way, was Jewish also." And, you know, again, it was like, what is this supposed to mean?
Why did that lead you to feel he was anti-Semitic?
Huh?
What made you feel that was a sign of anti-Semitism?
Well, I think that John put me and Jews in a separate category, and that is anti-Semitism to me. I think that he would not have made these statements in front of people who were not Jewish, and that led me to believe that he thought of us as different, which is a form of anti-Semitism.
In other words, if I'm understanding you correctly, you're saying that the fact that he would comment upon Jewish people or Jewish culture or food.
Yes, even in a positive manner, that he would set that aside and make a point of it was an alarm for me. I've had many, many other people do this as well, and it can be innocuous. It can also be insidious because I don't think that they realize what they're saying. And they're uncomfortable, and so they bring it up in a positive way.
In other words,
friendly. Well, I'll tell you the story about this person, and by the way, he was Jewish.
In other words, if I'm understanding you correctly, Pat, you feel that the fact that he would identify Jews specifically indicated to you that he did not see Jews or perhaps another group of people, say blacks or women or gays, as simply part of humanity? Am I understanding your implications?
Got it right there, Dave, exactly.
Okay.
As I said, if he were telling you the story about the same friend, he would not have said, "Oh, by the way, he was Jewish." He would say it to me because I am Jewish.
Okay, and again, this is not to cast aspersions on what you're saying, Pat, but this is one volunteer's opinion. Did you see, in your opinion, any other indications of similar attitudes by John towards other groupings of people?
I would say I felt rather than saw, because I really can't come up with anything concrete.
Because I know some of the other people have expressed concern that John was sexist.
Oh, well, that's my main. Okay. Okay, one of the things that John did was he was able to tap into things that were important to other people. And I am a feminist, and that's the issue that he chose to tap into with me. And he was able to do it very effectively at the beginning. And it took me a while to realize that what John would do is in a meeting or after a meeting, he'd come up to me or sit next to me in the meeting and point out sexist things that other men in the room were doing, and namely, it was in speech patterns.
Can you cite any specific?
Interrupting women or making a comment that they might not have been aware of was considered a sexist comment.
Can you think of any specific examples?
There were people in the group who obviously did not have respect for women, and they were cutting them off in conversations. And the conversations were part of a group meeting.
Can you give the first names of any of those men?
Yes, Al.
Okay. That, by the way, is a fellow whose name, on-air name, we should use that, is Will Robinson. And I also want to reiterate that this is Pat's opinion and should be taken as such, which is not to cast aspersions on you, but we are getting the subjective
right
recollections of what people went through. Go ahead.
That's true, but Al did constantly make comments like that at meetings, and there were times that we had to stop the meetings and point it out to him and say that we would not go on until he acknowledged that he had interrupted or cut off someone or was acting in that way. And as I said, what John would do would be to point out these things, and pointing them out was only detracting from his actions, which were very sexist.
Can you cite examples of what you considered to be sexism on his part?
Very, very basically, there were times when we had thank you parties for the volunteers for helping us work on a project, and at the end of the get-together, we'd notice that all the women were in the kitchen cleaning up and all the men were in the living room talking by the fireplace, which didn't sit well with any of us, me especially, and a comment would be made about it. And at that point, usually the men would come in and help. John never came in and helped.
Mm-hmm.
John never did anything that would have been considered woman's work. I never really saw John go out of his way to do anything to help the status of women or what we were fighting for. But yet it was very, very important to John to be recognized as a feminist.
That was something that I have heard John say, that he is a...
He went out of his way to convince other people that this was a very, very important issue, and not only... He would make a point of it. He would point it out even when it wasn't there. It was very important for him to be seen this way.
Okay. All righty. I have heard John refer to himself as a male feminist, but as I've indicated already, my own contacts with John, which were unpleasant as far as they went, were so limited and always within the context of professional relationships that I myself never saw indications of sexism on his part or, well, I shouldn't say I never saw indications of anti-Semitism, because he was associated in some fashion, as yet to be determined, with some right-wing tax protesters, and I will go into this later, some of whose members were into identity Christianity, the anti-Semitic theology of the Aryan nations. So I did see that indication, and it was one of the things his indeterminate, although relatively long-lasting relationship with elements of this group, and I don't know if he was associated with the group as a whole. I know he addressed them once, but I saw people from this group virtually every place I saw John Judge from 1984 through 1988. So that was one of the things that alarmed me about John, but I once again want to reiterate that I myself had so relatively little contact with him that I never saw this personally, which once again, Pat, is not to cast aspersions on what you're saying. One of the reasons that I am conducting these interviews is to get an understanding, both for myself and for the audience, of what really happened. I have heard some of these things firsthand or secondhand from people, but I have never really explored past a point from the volunteers themselves. I've heard from one or two, but what exactly happened?
Yeah. Well, it was all these things combined. Plus, John had this nasty habit of not really doing any of the work, but messing what you had done up. It was like leaving his mark on what you had done so that you then had to do it all over again, but he never did the work himself. But he would come in and he would constantly mess up what you were doing.
Can you cite a specific example?
We were setting up tables for tabling, and they had to be set up a certain way, and we had done all the setting up, and John had not arrived on time as he was supposed to help us do the tabling, and so we had done it by ourselves, and then he came in and he messed up the entire table, and when I asked him why, he sort of lost interest and walked away, and I had to go set up this entire table again.
Where was this table, Pat?
Well, this was at a nightclub in Berkeley on the evening of a memorial to Abby Hoffman.
Was that the La Pena Coffee House?
No. It was a nightclub, and I can't remember the name of it.
Okay.
Aya would probably know, because she was there.
All righty.
And this, we were asked to use only one table because Paul Krasner, who was the other guest that night, was using the other table. And so we moved all of our stuff onto one table. When John came in, he started spreading it out again. I explained why it was on one table. And he sort of just messed everything up so that we had to go back and reset it because we were short of space. And he had a habit of doing that constantly with people who worked with him. He would just come in and he would put his hands into things and mess them up so that you had to start and do them all over again. And this was very annoying given the fact that he wasn't doing any of the work himself and taking credit for everything that was being done. So this is just another minor little annoyance. It was one of the things that we noticed that he did constantly and seemed to have something to do with control.
All righty. Can you think of anything else, Pat, because we are limited for time here?
Yeah, there was just something that happened towards the end. John did eventually, after these meetings, after several of these meetings and discuss it, John did hand in a resignation, and there were some issues around the money, and he was asked to give an accounting for the money. And I'm not that familiar with that, except that I don't think he ever did give the accounting for the money.
We have heard in detail from Cayenne, who, as you know, was handling the May Brussel Center for the Brussel Estate. And it should be noted that at all times, the May Brussel Center, and by extension also all monies associated with it, were part of the Brussel Estate. It was never given to John Judge. But we have heard a detailed accounting of the financial shenanigans from Cayenne already.
Right. Well, I have one that, if Cayenne has mentioned it, I'll gladly not go on about it, but it was about the deposit for the house.
That has been recollected by Cayenne.
Okay.
But, Pat, we are pressed for time here, so if you could think of anything
that's
important.
That's about all I have, except that I would like to thank you for what you said on your show. Because you were the only one who came out and said anything about it.
Are you talking about my attack on the center or the criticisms?
I don't feel it was an attack. You told the truth.
Let me, in closing, read what Tom Davis said about how the center went down. There was a string of problems with this. This from the Jonathan Vanken book, Conspiracies, Cover-Ups, and Crimes, subtitled Political Manipulation and Mind Control in America by Jonathan Vanken, V-A-N-K-I-N. There was a string of problems with the center, one of them Judge's refusal to open it to the public. According to Davis, the new library will be open. But, says Davis, quote, one of the problems was Dave Emery, unquote. Davis says he personally implored Emery, to whom the May Brussel Research Center will always be, quote, so-called, unquote, not to attack the center on his show. In the fall of 1989, Emery burst. Restraining himself for a year, he could no longer hold it in, and went on the air accusing Judge of financial improprieties and other sordid acts. In private, Emery is even more vitriolic. Whatever the objective reality of the May Brussel Research Center controversy, the version that navigates the canals of Dave Emery's brain is another of his many traumas. What is your impression of both Tom Davis's, or what is your reaction to Tom Davis's assessment of my activities and also of Jonathan Vanken's view of what happened with the center?
Totally incorrect as far as your part in it. All I can tell you is that the volunteers and the employees did not feel that way about you at all, and especially about that show. There were no complaints about you ever. I never heard a complaint about you from any of the people working there.
Mm-hmm.
I never heard that you interfered in any way. When you did that show, we were so happy that someone finally said something about all of this that was going on when no one else was really willing to say it. Why Tom Davis said what he did, I really don't know, because in person to me, he never made any comments like that.
I suspect, and I will talk about Tom Davis later, I am not going to be interviewing Tom Davis for this program. I had originally planned to do that. But as I work out what I'm going to be going into, there just isn't going to be time. And frankly, Tom Davis has had his say, albeit in print under the circumstances. I pretty much cut Tom Davis loose after May died. I was trying to talk to him about what was going on with John. I had already seen some serious problems.
And Tom simply was of closed mind vis-a-vis what I had to say. Now, I, as a matter of course, do not associate with, and I will break off associations with anyone who does not listen to what I have to say. This is not to say they have to agree with what I say. They can disagree with what I say, but when they don't listen, I consider that relationship to be a waste of time. Life is simply too short. I severed contact with Tom Davis. No, well, I shouldn't say I severed contact, but I ceased to view him as an associate or a friend at the time of May's death, largely because of his obstinate attitude towards some of the things that I was trying to tell him and other people about what I had already observed with John Judge. So I suspect that that may have something to do with Tom's comments and reactions. And later on in the broadcast, I will discuss how utterly false many of the things quoted by Jonathan Vanken, said or allegedly said by Tom Davis, actually are, because the account that is in Vanken's book is literally fiction and readily demonstrable fiction.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Pat, I appreciate your recollecting for us what happened from your viewpoint, and once again, I want to reiterate that these are your opinions and recollections, subjective, some of them, although a number of them do agree with other people's experiences and recollections under the circumstances. I'm doing this again so that people can get some idea of what really happened as opposed to the nonsense that appears in Vanken's book.
Yes, I would like the truth to be known as well.
All righty, Pat. Well, I want to thank you for participating.
Okay,
and stay in touch, and I hope you're well.
Okay, thank you. Bye.
And that concludes the interview with Pat. We're going to continue with the interviews with some of the volunteers from the May Brussels Center. And again, I would stress that some of the things should be taken perhaps with a dose of salt, but what it is important here is the personal recollections of the personal experiences that the various members of the May Brussels Center had vis-a-vis John Judge, because this is central to what really happened with the May Brussels Center. I have live with me in the studio a volunteer named Betty.
Okay. Well, my husband and myself worked at the center from about July until its dissolution in December or January of either 89 or 90. And we worked indirectly for the center. And then John asked us to come to the center and work. And one of the things we noticed is that it seemed like John became more incompetent when there was a big project to do, and we mostly had to carry it off ourselves, such as the newsletter preparation or mailings and other information preparation, and he took credit for this. And one night late, he called Terry to bring over a plumbing snake that to clean the shower drains with, and Terry had volunteered to do this once before, and I came along, and he told me he had something for me to do too. And I assumed it had something to do with the research. And it turned out to be scrubbing the tile grout in his bathroom with what was described as a special strong chemical for this purpose. And I said I wasn't dressed for the for that. And I was uncomfortable with the chemical because I was unfamiliar with it. And I recall him saying something like, "Women are good at this sort of thing." And I expressed my disapproval for that remark. And he went on to explain that he thought I could do that, and he showed me how to use the chemical by scratching the grout with a finger and a rag with the chemical, despite me telling him that I was not prepared to do that at the time. And he splashed the chemical around and on me while demonstrating the cleaning technique. So I just took over the cleaning, hoping that things wouldn't get messier before Terry finished cleaning the drain in the shower.
And basically, he was having you clean his bathrooms.
That's what it turned out to be. And when Terry finished the drain, John had him start cleaning the tile grout in the shower in his bathroom where he had me working. We were led to believe that this was necessary for us to do to keep the center going, although we were volunteered to work, do work related to me, his research. That on another occasion, Terry and I were discussing different forms of anti-Semitic expression with John at the center, and I said I recalled someone saying that they believed Jews were from Mars, and that I found that disconcerting considering what had happened to the Jews already for not being thought of as human. In response, I recalled John saying he thought Jews were from Venus.
Was he making a joke?
Well, Terry and I felt we expressed discomfort because we thought, even if it's a joke, I mean, we thought that this kind of thinking didn't really have a place as far as the direction we understood the center to be taking, not in line with May's research and philosophy.
Again, I want to emphasize that some of these recollections are subjective and as such should be taken with a grain of salt. This is in no way Betty to cast aspersions on you.
Mm-hmm.
But Pat also had some of those feelings, and I myself never saw any manifestations on John's part of anti-Semitism. But when Cayenne went into open opposition, or really I should say when John went into open opposition with Cayenne, her husband received an anti-Semitic death threat, and her car was found vandalized the following morning, and John also was keeping company with some very interesting people. All of this may be coincidence. There are coincidences, and I fully acknowledge the possibility for the record, but on the other hand, it's possible that these were not coincidences. Go ahead.
I had a feeling that he was sexist, anti-Semitic, homophobic, and even racist, and I can't tell you all the other things that affected me that way, but those which I just told you about were specific instances that I can recall.
Okay, well, and again, I want to emphasize that some of this is subjective impression and as such should be taken as that and no more.
Mm-hmm.
And do you recall anything else about the center, Betty, that you think has not been in some of the previous interviews? By the way, we're also going to be hearing from Aya, who you heard mentioned earlier, the audience heard mentioned earlier, and from Karen Gutt briefly.
The only thing I could think of is that we were very disturbed that the center wasn't open to the public, and it didn't appear that it was going to be, and I understood that that was May's intention. And people who seemed very qualified to work there, in fact, oftentimes the more qualified they appeared to be, the more likely it seemed that John would declare them as agents and therefore a threat to the center.
Which is ironic in light of some of the company that John Judge had been keeping, and we're going to go into that later. Well, Betty, we are going to be pressed for time this evening, and I still have two more interviews to play via tape. I want to thank you for coming in and giving your recollections. And again, now this is in no way to cast aspersions on you, but people should bear in mind that some of this is subjective impression, as such should be taken with a generous dose of salt, and viewed as no more than that. But some of the experiences, for example, John Judge, the self-proclaimed male feminist, having women clean his bathroom, is to be taken note of, and we'll discuss that more later.
I appreciate you helping us clear the air.
Okay, thank you, Betty.
Thank you.
We're next going to hear from a volunteer named Aya, and this will be via tape, and this will be about a half hour in length. So those of you who are taping, this goes about a half hour. Here's Aya.
The next volunteer that we're going to be speaking with is Aya, who you heard alluded to by Pat in the previous interview. Hello, Aya, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay. What I want you to do, Aya, is simply to give your recollections about what happened with the May Brussels Research Center. As I've indicated already to the audience, I myself was not involved with the center except to give money to John Judge and also to contribute materially to the success of the Daniel Sheehan fundraiser. I have heard accounts of what happened, but I never set foot inside of the center and do not know firsthand what actually went down. If you would give your recollections of what happened with the center, in particular the volunteers, and why they had problems with John Judge.
Okay, first of all, I wanted to say that this thing that you destroyed the center is so awful. And I just want to read my resignation letter that I sent to Cayenne Russell. I think that will sum up everything. Because what happened with Judge was that it's little things that he did And when you took it all together, you realized who you were dealing with. It was like little individual, little things that may not seem a lot, but when everybody got together, he looked like a monster. So I wrote this letter when I finally had had enough to Cayenne. Anyway, it starts out with all my things that I had noticed, because I had talked to a lawyer and they told me to write everything down.
Okay.
Number one, pathological liar. And then I went down in all the examples that I had heard or witnessed or experienced myself. First of all, he had told a bunch of people, well, every time we came in during the day, he told us that he had worked every night. And that was what he had told me every time when I came in the morning, because that was my shift. And I thought, yeah, that's really good. You're a real hard worker. Anyway, one of the managers of the office told me one time about a month later that that wasn't true. So what I put down is lies about working at night, and I stayed over to see what had found out was that what he did was watch TV, eat, and have mostly personal calls. And then the next morning, he would tell volunteers that he worked all night.
Now, when you say calls, you mean telephone calls?
Personal calls to the West Coast to talking to friends.
Okay.
Anyway, and I didn't believe the person at first because I was like, John Judge was the cat's meow to me, and I had a lot of his tapes and stuff. But when this person told me this, it was her word or Judge's, you know, telling me every morning. So I came down a whole bunch of different days and spent the night, and I listened, and this person was right, and I was really surprised. Anyway, I don't mean to diverge, but it's just one mess after another about this Judge guy. Anyway.
If you could, be as specific as you can.
Okay, I'll just letter in. Okay. Okay, takes credit for work done by others. He said that he called people for meetings, and it turned out to be the office manager who did the calling. He did a lot of that. He took credit. What sums up him taking credit, for example, and I'm just using this one example, is that I would do a lot of the cleaning around the house and would like sweep and dust, and he would like the last 2 seconds say I want to help so that I can say that I'm helping, and he would like let people do a lot of work and then he'd come the last minute and then help so that he could take credit for everything, and that caused a lot of division amongst people. And when he wanted things done, he would say that the landlord was coming the next day, which was a lie. She lives on the East Coast. Then another thing happened. He said that he knew this woman, Wendy, which probably has been mentioned by a lot of other people in the center.
It has been.
Okay, that he knew her, told Betty and Terry that he knew her in childhood, and then he told me and this other woman that he had only met her over the phone. So that was a lie. Then there was this other woman that had lived at the center for about a month or two, and when I confronted him when everything was coming down, that he had known her for a long, long time, and I had heard that he had only met her on the bus. Well, anyway, it turns out that I contacted her, and she totally said she didn't know much about Judge and that she had met him on the bus. So, anyway, he lied about knowing her for a long time.
What was this woman's first name?
Terry.
Terry?
Yeah, and I had actually met her at the Abby Hoffman thing up in the city, and I confronted her, and she says, no, I don't know Judge. I don't know Judge. I just knew him from the bus, and he wanted me to live there with him. Okay, so that was a lie. Anyway, the other thing, the next thing down off the list was that he backstabbed everybody. And that was a long one because he always came to me about how much he disliked people and did a lot of backstabbing with Dr. Will and the KAZU, but, you know, to their face and on the radio, how great they were. So that caused a lot of hassle in the center.
Can you give some specific examples? You know, you already mentioned Will Robinson.
Yeah, well, what I put down. Okay. He stabs everybody in the back into their faces. He's nice. He disliked Dr. Will and said that he was going to get all the tapes back and change the locks and squeeze Dr. Will out of the center. But on the KZU radio fundraiser, he was saying how wonderful Dr. Will's show was and how good KZU was. But all the time, behind his back, Dr. was totally unprofessional and what a lousy show. And it was just really hearing him do this constantly, you know, about everybody, about Tom Davis. Tom Davis was this, and this other person was that, and I'm sure he talked about me, and he talked about all the other people to me, and, you know.
Ayad, now, are you saying that John Judge was backstabbing, quote-unquote, i.e., speaking unkindly about Tom Davis behind his back?
Yeah, and his son, and everybody, and I'm sure he did it to me. And
Can you recall any specific examples?
No, because I don't want to hear from Tom Davis.
Well, I don't think that is something that... The point here is I want to get as specific and hardcore, so to speak, as we can. So if you can think of some specific examples, because just to
Well,
cite...
I just told you about Dr. Will.
Okay, right. But how about Tom Davis? Can you think of any specific...
You know, just stuff like, oh, he's just an old man, he doesn't know what he's... That kind of stuff, you know.
But you did actually hear him put Tom Davis down behind his back. Well, you did?
Yes, I have.
Okay.
I couldn't tell you exactly what it was, but yes, I've heard him thrash everybody.
Okay.
That's for sure.
Now, you also
said... I even heard him tell about, you know, about Mae Brussels, about how she really didn't want him there when he came. You know, he just was a big mouth, okay? And I don't remember specifically because I didn't know. This is actually, all of this came down like the first week or two when he was confiding in me, because we kind of had a personal relationship, not sexual, but personal, because I'm, you know, I like to talk about personal stuff, and he was telling me a lot of personal stuff. And in that, he told me stuff about me and you know, and how much he disliked you. He went on and on about you. You know, about, you know, you're sick and you're this and you're that and you're violent and angry and, you know, blah, 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 blah. Anyway.
Yeah, it should be said that John Judge had no love whatsoever for me, and the feeling is mutual. But can you recall anything specific? Well, perhaps
I would. Maybe afterwards you can ask me more of that. Maybe it'll trigger something. I have
okay.
So many other things that he did.
Okay, go ahead.
Anyway, so, okay, the next thing was that he kept on insisting to me that he owned the library, that it was his, and that Mae Brussels left it to him, and that he just had a library on loan to the center. And that was a major thing between me and him, because I didn't understand it to be that way. I understood that, you know, he was maybe in care of it so that nobody would rip stuff off, but it was not owned by him. And he kept on reminding me, and I kept on reminding him that he didn't own it. So that was a big fight between us. Of course, this fighting didn't stop for the first 2 months, because I just wanted to keep peace. But when things finally went, I just threw everything in his face. Anyway, of course, then my next thing I have on the list is anytime I would confront him, he would apologize. But it was no big deal to me, because I knew he was going to do something like 10 minutes later, so his apologies didn't mean anything to me. Or then when I would confront him again, he would say, well, I'm really depressed, I'm not at my best. Or when we really got serious about certain things, he would go, well, I don't have time for that, we're already in the concentration camps. He used to always say that when we would confront him. He'd always do the concentration camp number. Well, I can't deal with my stuff, we're already dead, we're in the concentration camps. So that's the way he used to do his little blame, you know, how he couldn't take responsibility for himself. Okay, next thing on the list was he says he was non-sexist. And these are just little minor things, but when you add it up, you know, because he kept on tooting his horn about how, you know, gentle he was and how what a feminist he was, you know. And I bought all this. You know, he did look good. He sold himself. He was a good BSer. Anyway, what I started to realize something was happening was at this party in Watsonville, it was kind of a benefit for Mae Brussels, the center. And as usual, the women were doing all the cleanup and the men were talking, and finally we made it known to the men that we were tired of doing the cleanup, and a lot of the men came over and helped, but there was still John continuing to talk. And he went on and on, and finally we were in the car, and I was with these three other women we were mentioning. I mentioned John Judge was in the car too, and I said, yep, you know, it always is the women who does the cleanup. And then John said, oh, yeah, men are like that, man. They're just dogs, you know, as if he had been a woman and he was doing the cleanup. When we were actually all talking amongst ourselves, watching him talk, and we were saying, we were wondering when he was going to come over. So it started to make me think, this guy's delusionary, because he's acting like he was helping us clean when he wasn't. It's just real minor, but it started to make me think about how he was dealing with people personally, because he was such a collective, into collective and bargaining and, you know, reasoning things out. But in his personal life, when it came down to it, he was not doing any of this. Okay, the next thing he did, he was a real power into control and controlling things. And we used to talk about that in the center a lot. He'd, like, cord the mail, and a lot of times I wasn't able to see the mail. And then in one case, because I did a lot of the research and I filled the orders up for anybody who was, like, wanting an order on a certain subject, I would do the research and then I would send off the order. Well, at one point I got a letter from a person. It was a personal letter addressed to me. You know, the envelope was addressed to me. He opened it. He read it. my own personal mail, because he even refused me to have my own. He was such a control freak. He Xeroxed the thing and gave me the Xerox copy.
Now, are you saying that he would not allow you to have your own mail?
Well, he, in this case, he took the letter and he read it first. I got later on, like a week later, the Xerox copy of it. I found it.
Now, this was this personal correspondence?
To me.